morning, Vietnam.
That's how a new documentary about the Vietnam War begins. And if it sounds familiar, do not be fooled. The story gets into uncharted territory pretty quick. It's about a jail in Vietnam where the U.S. Army kept soldiers who went AWOL in the crazy heat and the chaos of war under all kinds of duress. And the story culminates in an uprising led by mostly African-American soldiers against the U.S. Army. This all really happened. 50 years ago today, in fact. So, seems like the kind of thing we would have heard about before, right? I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're going to hear from the radio producer who did the reporting on this about the story she's telling and why the veterans she met along the way haven't said a whole lot about it until now. Sarah Kramer, with us from Radio Diaries, welcome to the show.
Hi, great to be here. Thank you.
So, quick synopsis of your piece, which debuts today. Can you give us just the short version of the story?
Sure. During the Vietnam War, there was a military stockade outside of Saigon. It was called the Long Binh Jail, this was the largest army stockade in the country. And, you know, people might be surprised to hear that there was a jail for U.S. soldiers in Vietnam, but there actually always is a stockade during war. And the Vietnam War, as people probably know, was a drafty war. About a quarter of the troops were drafted. And in 1968, there were about 500,000 troops in Vietnam, and it was a time when the mood and the morale of soldiers started to kind of darken, and military discipline started to kind of fray, and a lot of soldiers began to rebel. A lot of soldiers started to walk off and go AWOL, and there was other kinds of criminal activity, insubordination, many things that happened at that time. And the jail became very overcrowded. It was built for 400 soldiers initially, and by the summer of 1968, there were over 700 people, men, who were incarcerated there. It was almost double the capacity. And over 50% were African American. And many African American soldiers felt that they were disproportionately punished during the war. Talked about discrimination in the system, and the tensions at the jail really started to build, and particularly in 1968, when there was so much upheaval going on in the United States, soldiers heard about that. They were aware when Martin Luther King was assassinated and when riots erupted in cities across the United States. And all of this context affected them. And on August 29th, 1968, 50 years ago today, an uprising broke out at the jail, and that's the story that we're telling.
So I feel like there are really three stories you're weaving together here. The story of the jail itself and how people were treated there, which is a crazy story in and of itself. The story of race in America while the Vietnam War was going on. And then finally, the story of this uprising and how it all went down. That's a lot. It's a, 15-minute documentary?
It is. It's a format breaker on All Things Considered that you can hear later today. It's a complicated story. We interviewed three former inmates who were there during the uprising, as well as a guard and a military official who was the deputy commander of the stockade, and Peter Arnett, who was the journalist for the Associated Press, who wrote about the riot when it happened. So a lot of voices, and we also wove through the story snippets of Armed Forces Radio, which was a radio that soldiers hosted and DJed during their service. And where that was one way that soldiers would get news of what was going on and also just keep, you know, the music of the 1960s.
But my question is, like, if I were a Vietnam scholar, would I have already known about this?
Yeah, it's interesting. Some certainly do. But yeah, this story has been largely forgotten, and it's largely left out of most histories of the Vietnam War. And there are a lot of reasons for that. I mean, it was a big war, and there was also just a lot of major news in 1968, and this event got overshadowed. The military, my understanding is that they didn't want it to be a big story.
You can kind of imagine that would be the case.
Yeah. I mean, this did not look good. The military, you know, did a thorough investigation after the riot to try to figure out what happened, why it happened. They knew it was a story about race. I think that they didn't entirely understand all of the factors that were going on. That was my sense from reading the report. But they knew it was a delicate and sensitive issue. And you know, this wasn't the only riot or uprising or protest that happened during the Vietnam War. There were actually many. This is one of the biggest ones. But that's a story that the story of kind of rebellion and protest of soldiers is one that has kind of been lost.
How did you find out about the Long Binh Jail uprising?
So there was an op-ed in the New York Times about a year ago by a professor, Gerald Goodwin, whose work focuses on race relations in the Vietnam War. And he wrote an op-ed that I read, and this was mentioned in it, and it just stuck out to me. And we at Radio Diaries, we do a lot of history stories, and we sort of specialize in forgotten history or little known history. And we like to tell these stories that we feel really resonate with stuff, you know, issues that people are talking about today, like race and punishment and incarceration. So it was that's how it got on my radar. And it's a fascinating story to work on because it's been sort of so little documented. I really had to do a lot of work to track down people to talk to. And honestly, it was hard to get people to talk about this story. I mean, a lot of people were nervous, had never shared their stories before. I think just, you know, the military is a sensitive subject for a lot of people. I mean, not to mention that the Vietnam War was just a very difficult time. And for many people in this story, these events were traumatic and hard to talk about.
Well, that does bring me to the reason why we are talking about this on a local talk show. One of the men involved in this uprising lives here in Kansas City, and he is a part of Sarah's documentary that's going to air on ATC, All Things Considered. Sorry for the insider lingo, but this afternoon. He is in the studio with me now. Jimmy Childress, good morning.
Good morning.
Have you talked about this before, talking about it for this documentary?
No, I have not.
Why not? Why and why open up about it now?
I haven't talked about it because it was a painful subject to talk about. I just thought with the passing of time that I would be able to open up, and I've been able to do that.
Does it feel good to tell your story, or has it been difficult?
It's difficult.
Well, I really appreciate you being here and doing that. I'm going to ask you some questions about your experience, if you don't mind. I do want to hear the story from your perspective, starting with the jail itself and what it was like there, the Long Binh Jail for U.S. soldiers in Vietnam.
It was very difficult. You were treated inhumane. You were given very little to eat. You had to fill sandbags in 115-degree heat every day. You didn't have adequate showers or anything like that. The guards treated you bad because they actually didn't want to be there themselves. So it was a difficult time, very difficult.
Why were you in the Long Bend jail to begin with?
Refusing to fight anymore. I refused to fight anymore.
Can you explain that?
Well, after seeing so much death and destruction and seeing my best friend killed, I just decided that, I'll fight no more.
How did you make that stance known? Did you just, can you set that stage for me a little bit?
I more or less walked away with five or six other guys who had also refused to fight. And every time I would come in off of what's called a three-day stand-down, you would come in to a resupply, take a hot shower, get a hot meal and stuff like that. And when I would come in, they would encourage me to leave. This is not your war. We have a fight in America. The first time I didn't listen, but the second time I did. So I walked away with them.
Who was saying this is not your war?
Black guys who had also refused to fight, and they would try to encourage black soldiers to not go back in the field or out in the jungles, and you're not going to come back next time, and, this is not your fight. We have a fight in America. And second time I listened to them.
How did you feel about being fighting for the U.S. Army in Vietnam at this particular time in history with your own personal backstory?
I didn't feel good about it, actually, because I'd had a more or less difficult life in America, difficult childhood, being locked up at 10 years old for taking a bicycle, stuff like that, It all started coming back to me, being in reform schools for not going to school and, So a lot of things that had happened in my life in the past, it all started coming back to me.
Tell me, was your childhood here in Kansas City?
Yes.
Tell me about it. I mean, you have hinted, more than hinted, that it was difficult, but tell me more about exactly where you grew up, what it was like there.
Well, I grew up in Kansas City, Kansas, in a Christian home. My mom was a highly devoted Christian woman. She's 90 years old now, and my dad was a minister, and so I grew up in a good Christian home. I guess it was me that chose to not go to school and rebel.
Can you tell me more about, what the pressures were on you that maybe influenced that? Because you're talking about that, you thought about your struggles in your childhood mm-hmm. there when you were off at war.
Right. Well, I guess I can say that I started thinking about a lot of things that had happened in my life. I started thinking about the reason why I was in Vietnam and what brought me to Vietnam, the draft papers I received. When I received draft papers that came into my mailbox from greetings from the President of the United States, you are hereby inducted into the armed forces. And my brother looked at me and said, are you going? I said, no, I'm not going. So what happened was I got in trouble with the law and ended up in jail. And I was given a choice by the judge, you either go to the Army or go to prison. So I chose the Army, and that's why I ended up in the Army, and that's why I ended up in Vietnam. I went through basic training, advanced infantry training, and I went to jump school where I jumped out of airplanes. And I would say 8 months, in stateside. Before I finished paratrooper school, I got orders to Vietnam and got a 2-week leave home, and that was it. And next thing you know, you're on a plane going to some unknown country that you never heard of.
And you, I mean, when this uprising happened, you were 18, right?
Yes.
And in the documentary, which I've heard a rough draft of, you talk some about what you as a black man were not allowed to do in your own country, and that you had done some thinking about that too.
In my own country?
Yeah.
This country, America?
Yeah.
I don't recall that.
Just talking about not being able to vote, not being able to sit at a lunch counter.
Oh, well, I remember those days as well. My mom would take my brother and I and my sister to a downtown store, and they had a counter there, and, my mom would buy my brother and I and my sister something to drink or some ice cream, and we could not sit at the counter. We had to take our beverage or whatever we had outside, and I guess it was very difficult for a mother to tell a 9 or 10 year old child that, you know, you're not good enough to sit at a counter. But those things happened during the time I was growing up.
And was that something you were thinking about when you decided not to fight anymore?
I thought about everything in a flash, everything. I thought about everything that had gone on in my life, and, you know, I thought about everything, and I just decided to rebel, and that's what I did.
Were there murmurs about an uprising before it happened, or was it more spontaneous?
You mean the riot?
Yeah, and, you know, that's an interesting thing, the terminology.
Well, we were already, as black soldiers anyway, but white soldiers, Mexicans, Indians, they all felt the same. They all felt the heat. They all felt the pressure. But us black soldiers, I think we felt it a little bit more. We felt that we had been taken halfway around the world just to be killed. We felt it was a form of genocide that we felt that had been going on in America for 400 or 500 years against a black man. We felt that it was a form of genocide, and this is just another form of genocide. And we have become very hostile. We have become very uneasy, and we knew what was going on in America due to our news clippings that we received. And I guess when Martin Luther King was killed, I was in a stockade, and I think I felt like many other black soldiers felt that, you know, that was the push over the edge for us. And
so how did the uprising 50 years ago today, mm-hmm. how did it go down?
Well, we decided to solicit a guard who was on a tower to bring us marijuana and to bring us a bag of these pills that were called Benactol pills. You take one and you think you're Superman. So he agreed to bring that in. And we knew that it was coming in on a certain night. And on that certain night, we had warned everyone, when you hear the whistle blow, tear the place up. And when the marijuana and the binoculars were threw over to us, we went around and distributed to, you know, a lot of people, mostly black, you know, to get everybody rigged up. And that happened. Everybody did get rigged up, because at the time we were sleeping in open tents to where, you know, you had freedom to more or less walk around or roam around, but you still had two or three guards in there keeping watch on everyone. So we just said, when you hear the whistle blow, then that's the time to come out. And that's what happened.
This is a pretty crazy story to keep close to your chest for all these years.
It is.
How has this sort of reverberated in your mind, this whole experience, especially not speaking it out loud to other people?
It was an experience. A lot of things about Vietnam I never, you know, mentioned to anyone, not even to my own family, because I felt they wouldn't believe it anyway. So, you know, I chose to keep my mouth shut. And another reason I didn't mention anything about Vietnam, because it was painful to talk about my experience in Vietnam, They talk about, you know, the riot. They talk about, you know, guys that I know that, you know, did not make it back. And I just didn't feel comfortable in even discussing Vietnam, watching war movies on TV or having anything to do with the military, period.
I do notice that you are wearing your Vietnam veteran cap today.
Yes.
Tell me about that. What that hat means to you to be wearing it today.
It means that I feel being a part of something that was very dramatic. I wear it in honor of fallen soldiers that did not make it back. I wear it in honor of myself having gone through Vietnam. And I wear it as a symbol of the history of America.
I'm Gina Kaufman. We're going to get right back to this discussion of the Long Binh Jail uprising in Vietnam 50 years ago today. We're going to hear about veterans like Jimmy Childress who are just now coming forward with their stories about it when KCUR's Central Standard returns. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're learning about the Long Binh Jail uprising during the Vietnam War. It was led by mostly African-American soldiers who'd been imprisoned abroad by the U.S. Army. Sarah Kramer of Radio Diaries has produced a documentary about it, and a local man, Jimmy Childress, is one of the voices in that documentary, which you can hear on All Things Considered today. Jimmy, hello again.
Hello.
And Sarah, welcome back.
Thank you.
So, okay, you guys, one note about terminology. I've been saying uprising. A lot of people have called this a riot. Some have even called it a race riot. And Jimmy, you take particular issue with race riot.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, I want you to understand that the riot at the stockade was not about race. Even though there are some that disagree with me that it was about race, it was not about race. I know that for a fact because the riot actually probably never would have taken place if it hadn't been for, you know, the uprising going on in America. If it hadn't been for the fact that Martin Luther King was killed, I think that was the straw that broke the camel's back. And it wasn't a race riot in LBJ, which was called Lyndon Baines Johnson Ranch. Lyndon Baines Johnson was president during the time.
Long Binh Jail and Lyndon Baines Johnson happened to have the same initials, and that works for you.
That's what everyone called Long Binh Jail, Lyndon Baines Johnson Ranch. That's what it was called. And, it was a combination of things going on in America, the way a black man felt being halfway around the world, being locked up and being humiliated. And, you know, like I say, that was the straw that broke the camel's back. And it wasn't a race riot, in my opinion. It was a riot against the U.S. Army and the U.S. government.
Sarah, did you talk to other people about this terminology issue?
I did, yes. You know, it's interesting. I think that the way this story has been remembered is complicated. You know, during the riot, one man was killed, a white inmate. His name was Edward Haskett. And because it was a white inmate who was killed, and the majority of the leaders of the uprising were black, I think that led to kind of the terminology of the events being, called a race riot, which, you know, is a very loaded term. But I think that the larger issue is that it became remembered as being very, like, racially motivated. But, you know, I spoke to a number of former inmates at LBJ, and, you know, all of the African-American former inmates that I spoke to said that that's not what it was about. You know, like Jimmy, say that it was a, you know, it was, there was a, they were angry, they were fed up about their treatment and about larger systematic racism. And you'll hear in the story that they were focusing their anger on tearing the stockade down. And so, you know, I think that this is, you know, speaks to just like the complicated messiness of history and how we remember stories. And that's, you know, something that we kind of like to dig into at Radio Diaries.
Jimmy, you know, you have said that it's partly what was going on in America that you were hearing about while you were in Vietnam that was stirring you up. And I'm curious, you know, when you came back to Kansas City, that must have been a strange experience. A lot had happened here, too. The same year you were rising up against your own army in Vietnam, there were demonstrations in the streets in Kansas City, businesses shut down, fires breaking out in response to the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. Was that a surprise when you came back, the specific Kansas City history, or did you know about that, too?
I knew about what had happened in Kansas City. I knew about what had happened in cities all over America. And coming back from Vietnam, it was a kind of a weird experience because you didn't get a welcome home. You were called baby killers and, you know, a lot of different names. You would go try to find a job, and the applications during the time, you know, mentioned military, and you were in the military in Vietnam. You know, you were shot out the door. You know, nobody wanted to deal with you. Nobody wanted to have anything to do with you. So it was difficult coming back to America, yes.
Sarah, you've talked to a lot of people with stories like Jimmy's, and but of course every story is different. And I know you don't want to tell everybody's story today, nor do we have time for that. But is there someone else whose story you just really want to share right now?
You mean as part of, you know, the characters in this piece?
Yeah.
I mean, I think this piece, I feel it's like a real oral history of what happened. And there are so many, you know, every person in the story is fascinating in their own right. Just, you know, I mean, the military, because it, and the soldiers who were in Vietnam, because it was a draft, largely, you know, it was like a draft army, and just the scale of the war meant that there were soldiers from all over the United States, from all different kinds of backgrounds. One of the other inmates that's in the story, his name is Scott Riley. He's an African-American man as well, from New York. And he's someone who got disillusioned with the war when he was fighting. He was, in the 1st Air Cavalry, you know, in a lot of firefights. And he ended up becoming a drug addict in Vietnam, which is something that, all, you know, a story that happened to many, many soldiers. Drugs were easy to come by. And drugs were what led him into the prison. But drugs were also what he says, you know, helped him get by while he was a soldier there. It was such a difficult experience. You know, he had a hard time coming back to the United States, but ultimately beat his drug addiction and now works in a drug rehab center. There's a white inmate who you'll hear in the story, Richard Perdomo, who lives in Tennessee. And, you know, he was somebody who is sort of representative of the petty infractions that might land people in the stockade. You know, military law is very broad. You can be reprimanded harshly for just refusing a direct order. And in his case, you know, he refused. He was told by a senior officer to change a flat tire on a truck. And it wasn't his truck, and he said he wasn't going to do it. And they sent him to the stockade. And, you know, the fact that there were people in that stockade, some of definitely were there for very serious crimes, but many were there for very, very small things. But the conditions that they had to endure were very, very harsh. And so I think that's just, it's a story that should be told about the military and about, how they, you know, the way their approach to punishment during the war.
I mean, the military, the U.S. government took most of us guys fresh out of high school, you know, and we were given 8 months of training to go halfway around the world to fight people we never heard of who had been fighting for 1,000 years. And one thing I know about, you know, that now is you can't whoop a man in his own backyard, and that's what they expected us to do. And the average soldier was 18 years old, and your company commander was 22 to 25 years old. You're sure there was a C.W. Westmoreland, who was the general of all the troops in Vietnam, but you were taking orders from kids themselves, and you were a kid.
Jimmy, did this experience not, I mean, the specific experience of the Long Binh Jail uprising, did that shape your life in ways that nobody around you has understood until now?
Yes. Yes, it has. When I hear stories about it being a race riot, that shook me up pretty bad. I didn't hear that until I heard it from Sarah. And I strongly objected and told her that it was not about race. If there were beefs amongst black and white inside the stockade before the riot, and somebody saw the opportunity to take revenge on someone that they didn't like, then that's what happened. But as far as the riot was concerned, it had nothing to do with, you know, a man of another race. It had only thing it had to do with was the government and the U.S. Army and the way we were being treated, less than human, I would say.
Sarah, what do you understand differently about either American history or the Vietnam War or something possibly even bigger than that as a result of making this documentary?
Well, you know, this has been a really amazing story for me to work on and to get to know Jimmy and the other people that are characters in the story. And also just to become more educated about the experience of black soldiers in the Vietnam War. I mean, I think that story has been, you know, that larger story has been unfortunately left out of the larger, you know, narrative, the sort of general narrative that we hear about the Vietnam War. And so for me, I mean, I just, I feel that it's opened up a lot of questions for me about the war and the military. And I've just been really moved by Jimmy's story and others. I'm glad to share it with everyone.
Sarah Kramer with us from Radio Diaries. Thank you so much for your reporting.
You're welcome. And please, if you missed the live broadcast, check it out on the Radio Diaries podcast.
Thanks for that reminder. And Jimmy Childress, thank you for sharing your story. It really means a lot.
Thank you.
Jimmy is a Vietnam veteran whose voice you'll hear in Sarah's documentary. Today is the 50-year anniversary of the Long Binh Jail uprising. We'll be turning our attention to the arts when Central Standard returns. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now the Open Spaces Arts Festival is doing a lot of things. But one of the things I'm excited about is how they're bringing in artists from all over the world to immerse themselves in the Kansas City landscape. I'm from here. I've lived most of my life here. And I think it's cool to get a fresh look at my own town through people who are seeing it for the first time, especially when those people happen to be artists. So we're going to be talking with all of these folks, not all of them, a lot of them. Once a week, starting today, with Matthew Jensen. He's a Brooklyn-based artist who's made a map of Swope Park. Matthew, good morning.
Good morning.
You are a super interesting case to me because this is actually what you do as an artist. You go to places you're not from and you make maps of those places for locals.
Yeah, well, I I do that. That's the nature of, I think, anybody who works in the landscape. I've done a lot of work in my own backyard, but eventually your backyard runs out of options, and so you have to start working using those strategies in other places. And so I've worked all over New York City. I live in the Bronx and work in the Bronx.
Excuse me.
That's all right. I used to live in Brooklyn. and at least you live in Manhattan. But so I've worked a lot in the five boroughs and in the park system here. It's been a big part of my practice. Moved out into the perimeter parks in New Jersey, and then have had the chance to work in other parts of the country, and most recently in Kansas City.
Why do you like to make maps of places for the locals? I mean, what is that about?
Yeah, so it does seem counterintuitive that somebody who isn't from a place would make a map of a place, but that is kind of the fun challenge. I really love diving into history and looking hard at a place and trying to find something that surprises even the locals. It's kind of my goal is to meet the experts and to meet the people who are working in a landscape currently, and then to see if I can find something either in a photograph, an object, or in a history archive that actually surprises them that they didn't know.
So what did you find in Kansas City?
Well, in Kansas City, I found just a beautiful river that's running through a few counties and ending in the Missouri. So my goal was to just be kind of an adventure on the Blue River, which is something that some people know about and some people don't. And a lot of people have experiences along the river and its tributaries in different ways. But I guess what did I discover? I discovered a lot of amazing confluences, great places to walk. And then I discovered a few things buried in archives, a really old, like I was able to find thanks to the downtown branch of the library has this really great Missouri River history room. And so they had a really great archive of local history. And I was able to find this little pamphlet from 1897 that was devoted to the Blue River and actually had photographic images of the Blue River and tributaries. And it was a promotional piece put out by the local railroad. But it was still a fascinating artifact, and there was a little poem devoted to the Blue River in there that I was able to piece together and put into this map. And so it was neat to find something from 1897 written about the Blue River, and that kind of little artifact had kind of been lost. And there are other little fun facts like that I found about the Blue River, like the name of a river creek that had never been incorporated into contemporary maps.
Your map actually leads people on a walking tour of where to catch glimpses of the Blue River without having to pay admission. Like that you yeah. point out that most of the prominent views of the Blue River are from private property, and you also describe the Blue River as generally being very good at hiding.
Yes. Yeah, so the walk is designed because of open spaces. The art festival is in Swope Park, kind of centered there. And so I designed a walk that would kind of bring you on an experience that I had and that I would have as an artist walking in the landscape. So that it just focuses on basically a really tiny little swath of Swope Park that allows you to see the river at a few points. And there are a lot of places where you can see the river from a bridge or from a few parks. But as you leave Swope Park, it gets more and more difficult to find the river as you go east, west, or up into the tributaries.
Why is it hard to find a river? That seems so weird.
It does seem weird, but a lot of people that I spoke to there are like, oh yeah, I have never really been to it or seen it. And so that was, so for me, one of the first things I start to learn, even from reading and from talking to people, is the relationship of a landmark or landscape to the people around it, and trying to understand how that relationship has evolved over time from its earliest days to right now, and how did it arrive where we are. And so in New Jersey, across the river here, we have a similar situation with the Passaic River. It's almost an identical scenario where you've got the headwaters in this beautiful swampland. People drink the water up in the headlands. But by the time the Passaic ends in the Hudson River, it's a mess, and it's notoriously for being a mess. And the same thing happens with the Blue River. It's just sort of beautiful at its start, and by the time it reaches the Missouri, it's had a hard run.
Yeah, one of the stops on this tour is a pile of tires that came out of the river.
Yeah, so that was a really exciting find. Before I was able to get to Kansas City, I had been looking at the local stewardship groups. So there's the Blue River Watershed Association, which is actually headquartered in Swope Park. And then there are other groups that have been working to get the river kind of a new life and to build trails and clean out invasives and get, in this case, tires out of the river. And so I had seen their work and watched some of their YouTube videos and on their Facebook page. So I was excited to find that there's already a lot of people in Kansas City trying to kind of bring some new life back to the river. And so when I got to Kansas, to Swope Park, I went to this one point, and then there was this giant tire of piles. And it's still there, thankfully. And so it kind of almost feels like an earthwork. It's just this giant, long tire pile, and it's the scary thing because all the tires came from the river and they still have mud on them, but it's also wonderful because all of the people who kind of had to kind of wade through brush and mud to pull these tires out and put them there, and it becomes this kind of symbol for we can do it.
Now, we are living in an age of GPS, and people are used to following maps that are on screens, and there's like a dot that represents you moving toward your destination or moving away from your destination. It is very different to be walking on the ground in a sprawling park with a paper map and a personal narrative, basically.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, you know, I don't actually have a smartphone, and I've yet to get one. And part of my not having that kind of relationship with technology is I want to have that kind of unmitigated experience with the landscape. I want to be able to get a little lost, knowing that I'm not going to get too lost. I want to kind of get turned around and find things on my own and ask people for directions, all those things that people used to do. And so giving people a paper map, this object, it functions as both an artwork. It sits in a pile. It's a beautiful photograph on one side. And then you turn it over, and then if you fold it up, you can stick it in your pocket, and then, yeah, you can have me. It's a way I do other projects where I give after I'm done working in a landscape, I will give a few artist walks. I become a sort of mini quick expert of a place, and I know it in weird ways, and I love to share that. And the only way to best share that apart from a tour is a map, because these maps, we have 10,000 of them. They're free. We can give them out. I can email them. They're all online, and so it's a way for me to kind of share this experience, re-engage people with the landscape, but then also just kind of be in people's ears while they're walking through. They can read this before they get there or while they're there, and just kind of have sort of know that somebody else has done it. That might break the ice, and it kind of eases some tensions and nerves about going into a place you've never been, and so you know someone's been there.
I want to jump in and say, you know, it sounds fairly deliberate on your part, but something going into it that people should probably be aware of. If you're used to navigating spaces sort of like immediately point A to point B, there is more work that you're going to be doing. I started the tour yesterday, and I'm going to have to finish it another time because I didn't allot enough time. I would predict that this would take about a half a day to complete. Do you think I'm wrong?
I know, it wouldn't take that long.
You don't think so?
Well, see, the problem is, and that's okay if it does. It's really like, if you didn't stop to like marvel at plants and look at trees and look at the rivers, it's about a little less than 2 hours of a clip. It's a short walk. It's very doable in a morning.
But that's assuming you never go the wrong way, which on foot, if you go the wrong way, correcting takes a little while. And I'm not saying that to be rude. I do think that that is its own kind of experience, as
absolutely.
You were saying.
Absolutely. Yeah. So in some ways, I hope that people fold this map up and don't use it. If they just kind of know where they should be, that there's this space over here and that there are these trails that are very well marked over here at the Lakeside Nature Center, then they can kind of at least have an experience. And then maybe they'll remember something from reading the map, because it's really awkward to have a map when you're walking. You do just want to just enjoy the landscape, and so you can kind of memorize this script a little bit and hear what I said. And then if you take a left instead of a right, you know, then you're not going to go too far off trail, but you'll have your own wonderful experience of this part of the park.
Well, Matthew Jensen, thank you so much for talking with me today.
No, thank you for having me.
And now, before we go, KCUR's Laura Spencer is here to tell us what she recommends at Open Spaces this week. Hi, Laura.
Hi, Gina.
So, what's it going to be?
Well, it was hard to narrow it down to one, but since today is Charlie Parker's birthday, I thought I would mention a few art installations in the 18th and Vine District. There are five, and a few of them are best viewed at night. And so tonight, the Mutual Musicians Foundation is having an earlier than usual jam session. It's usually at midnight, but tonight it's from 6 to 9. So if you're down in 18th and Vine District, you can check out a few of the art installations. One of them is Nari Ward's Claim. It's a light box and saxophone right outside the Mutual Musicians Foundation. And it has the numbers of Charlie Parker's childhood home at 1535 Olive Street. You've probably seen kind of the old-fashioned, you know, people holding a sign with numbers, and it has 5139, and it was the city's registration code. So that's right outside of the Mutual Musicians Foundation. Foundation. And there's also one other piece inspired by Charlie Parker by Nikita Gale. And it's in yellow neon on the Boone Theater. And so that's also in 18th and Vine District. And it has the words, "I adore your every move." And it was a line that Charlie Parker had written in a letter. And so it's now placed on the side of the Boone Theater.
"I adore your every move." Who was this a letter to? Do we know?
This was a letter to Charlie Parker's common law wife. And we actually have an article that Julie Dunashay wrote about this. Kind of a contentious relationship with a lot of different people because of addictions and travel. And so it seems like you can read a lot into that line, sort of poignant, but also, you know, a lot to read into it.
And so you said that you had a lot of trouble narrowing this down. Do you want to tell us about some runners-up?
Well, also tonight, there is an opening at the Nerman Museum of Contemporary Art. A lot of the art installations that are part of open spaces are clustered in Kansas City, Missouri, but there are a few that are also in at the Nerman Museum. And Michael Reese, there's an exhibition of his work that opened earlier this month, but the opening is tonight. And so the artist...
Michael Reese, tell me more about him.
He is a sculptor and also works in digital art. And folks might be familiar with a giant work that's in downtown Kansas City, a putti. There's a digital work behind it, but it's also this sculptural figure. And so his work at the Nerman is in plastic, and there's also a digital augmented reality aspect to it, too. So you can hear
the piece downtown. Is that the one near the Folly?
Yes. Yeah.
So if people have seen that while they're out to go to a show at the Folly, mm-hmm. then they might be curious to catch more of that at the Nerman?
That's right. And the opening is tonight, and the artist will be speaking about his work at 7.
So with open spaces, does the sort of commemoration of Charlie Parker that happens every year feel different to you?
Well, I don't remember a time when you can go to the Mutual Musicians Foundation and hear a jam session at 6, which is, you know, terrific for some people who aren't always, you know, up at midnight to hear the jam session.
So, for example, people with small children.
That's right. Exactly. So, yeah, I think that it's interesting to be able to make those connections in the neighborhood and not just in one place, but by walking around and seeing some of the other installations.
Of course, being at a jam session at 6 p.m. will feel different. It has to.
That's right. Yeah, although it's a little overcast today, so I think that, it'll definitely have a different vibe. And in what I'd read about it, it's called Parker's House Party, and a relative of Charlie Parker, his grandson, Brian Parker, will be there. So it'll be kind of an interesting, you know, opportunity to talk to somebody who, you know, has personal stories.
Okay, so you're focusing on things that commemorate Charlie Parker in 18th and Vine for your recommendations this week, but... Again, you said that you had a hard time picking, so maybe
right.
One more runner-up before we go?
Well, looking ahead, I'm going to guess some folks were at Swope Park last weekend with the official opening in the Village, and it was extremely hot, but this weekend it'll be a little bit cooler. It'll be in the 80s, so if you're going to see one of the shows on Saturday or Sunday, it's a open-air pavilion, so there's a nice breeze, and it'll be a little bit cooler. It's also shady. The Kansas City Roomba Collective is going to perform on Sunday, and if you were ever in Luce Park, it's started by a man, Agustin Romero Diaz, who came to Kansas City from Cuba, and so this kind of tradition carries on of this kind of music, but it will, instead of in Luce Park, it will be at Swope Park under the pavilion, and that'll be on Sunday afternoon, so that should be a fun performance.
What have you done so far? I mean, it's been... 1 week, and a week ago we spoke about what you were expecting. Have you been surprised?
Well, it was interesting out there on opening weekend. I think the big crowd on Saturday, even though it was 95 degrees, a little bit quieter on Sunday. So I think people are still just hearing about it. But I have seen a lot of people with their maps walking around looking for the installations, maybe getting lost in Swope Park. But so I think that, you know, people are starting to explore a little bit.
Our time is up. Laura Spencer, thank you so much.
Thanks, Gina.
Laura is the arts reporter here at KCUR, and we spoke just a minute ago with Matthew Jensen, one of the Open Spaces artists. If you want to go back and catch anything you missed from today's show, you can do that at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's kcur.org/centralstandard, which is also where you can sign up to have these conversations sent to you. If you'd rather listen on your own time, then make an appointment to listen live at 10. Of course, we love it when you listen live at 10, but sometimes you're busy and And that's why we've got these conversations ready for you online. KCUR.org/Central Standard. Tomorrow, what do Kansas City theater audiences really want? Does our taste kind of lean conservative? And if so, is that a problem? That discussion tomorrow at 10. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Kathleen Pointer, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next on KCUR, so don't miss it.